Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Last week, in the culmination of an historic and revolutionary Supreme Court term, the court issued a sweeping opinion curtailing the Environmental Protection Agency's ability to issue regulations on climate change. Specifically, the court ruled that in crafting rules to reduce carbon emissions from U.S. power plants, the EPA had gone beyond its congressionally granted authority. West Virginia Attorney General Patrick Morrissey led the lawsuit against the EPA, and here he was on Fox News the day of the ruling.
This is a huge victory for our American system of government. We've been arguing for many, many years, while everyone's been focusing on the question of climate change, we've said one simple thing, that if you have a major issue of the day, Congress needs to be the decider, not an unelected bureaucracy. That's what today's decision means. It ensures that these unelected bureaucrats are not going to be seizing power across the board.
The next day, White House National Climate Advisor and former EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy was on MSNBC. She said the ruling does not completely hobble the EPA in its efforts to fight climate change. However,
what it did was tell us that the Supreme Court is more interested in special interests that are being funded by the fossil fuel industry than they are in protecting public health and giving the agency the right and opportunity and obligation to actually keep our air clean. Keep our water clean, and address the existential challenge of our time.
Well, today we'll look at the ruling's impact on the EPA and beyond, its impact on federal agencies across the board. And we'll start today with Christine Todd Whitman. She's the former governor of New Jersey and served as EPA administrator under President George W. Bush. Governor Whitman, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Megan.
So, first of all, tell us how severely do you think the court's ruling does limit EPA's ability to regulate carbon emissions in the country?
Well, you know, I think it's going to take years before we fully appreciate the enormous impact that this ruling is going to have, not just at EPA, but as you mentioned before, across federal agencies, the FDA, how we regulate our food, how we make sure our drugs are safe. All this seems to be influenced by industry. And what was interesting to me, or ironic, I should say, by the quote that you played from the Attorney General of West Virginia, was that he said, you know, this is bureaucracy run wild. EPA would have far rather had the Congress act on climate change. In fact, there was all kinds of pressure putting on back when I was head of the EPA, but Congress wouldn't act. That's the problem. Congress didn't act, so EPA had to start to move forward because its mandate from the Congress is pretty simple: protect human health and the environment. And clearly, climate change and what is being emitted from these power plants is affecting human health and the environment. It's that simple. Mm.
Can you tell us a little bit more about, in more detail, about what you just said about when you were EPA administrator, there were already pressures on EPA, but Congress wouldn't act? What specifically do you mean by that?
Well, we felt that there was a real need to address the issue of climate change. And there was a lot of talk going on, not in formal bills being put up, but for staff to staff with the Hill to deal with this issue. They knew the issue was there. I said it publicly. Other people said it publicly that it would be far better. EPA would prefer it if Congress acted, because then it was the law. Anytime EPA promulgates a regulation, it goes to court, and you see the kinds of things that can happen. It can go forward, it can go backwards, but it takes a long time. And particularly if you're trying to stop behavior that is imperiling human life and health, then you want to act. But it takes a long time to wend these things to wend their way through the courts, and the bad behavior is going on during all that time. And of course, it's a really unfortunate thing for many with these emitters, the big emitters, the power plants and stations, that they're located near low-income communities. These are the people that get impacted the most by some of the worst pollution. And it's why you see such disparities in health amongst the lower income population and the upper income population. I mean, it's bad on so many levels, and it does undermine. It doesn't stop EPA from regulating. No, I mean, it can still go forward. But last I heard, when I was at EPA, there was one scientist in Congress. I don't believe there's a single one there now. And yet the court has said they're the ones who have to make scientific determinations on what's good to protect human health and the environment.
Well, so that's what Justice Kagan asserted in her dissent, that effectively the court was saying it possesses more expertise than EPA. But in the majority opinion, I'm seeing here that Chief Justice John Roberts really puts this back on Congress. I mean, he said specifically a decision of such magnitude, the nationwide transition away from the use of coal-generated electricity, he said, a decision of such magnitude and consequence rests with Congress itself, or an agency acting pursuant to clear delegation from that representative body. It's the lack of clear delegation. Now, I take your point about how Congress wouldn't act, but the justices are saying, well, they can't do anything about Congress not acting. They're simply reading per the Constitution. The authority rests with Congress. So what else could, how else could they rule?
Well, except that that is ignoring entirely what Congress charged EPA with when they set it up, was protecting human health and the environment. Period, the end. And this is part of that purview, part of that responsibility. So when Congress won't act, it is clearly up to the agency to do what Congress told it to do back in 1970 when it was first established. By the way, established and signed into law by a Republican president working with a Democrat Congress back in the Democratic Congress, back in the days when people would talk to one another and work together. So I still think that from the perspective of the courts, it's fairly clear that really EPA has no choice but to act in these instances.
Right. And in fact, the court, as you well know, Governor Whitman, even asserted as much in the case back in 2007 that sort of led to this point, right? That was the Massachusetts versus EPA case that in 2007, right. the Supreme Court ruled that carbon dioxide is a pollutant under the Clean Air Act. This was a ruling that came from the Supreme Court, and the High Court directed the EPA to regulate it, and that's what gave birth to the Clean Power Plan, which West Virginia sued.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, go ahead, Governor.
There's this jerking back and forth and back and forth, and the willingness of this court to undo precedent to the outside, well, frankly, to me, it looks as if it's pursuing a very political agenda rather than one based on the case law in front of them and precedent the way the court used to do it. And it's an activist court. It's reaching for those cases that will allow it to move forward on a very conservative agenda. And that's not the way the court is supposed to behave.
Mm. Well, Governor Whitman, stand by here for just a second, because I want to bring Lisa Graves into the conversation. She joins us from Superior, Wisconsin. She's executive director of the progressive watchdog group True North Research, was also formerly in the Justice Department as well. Lisa Graves, welcome to you.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So, first of all, tell me, you just heard Governor Whitman and also, in a sense, former EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy in the clip that we played, both say that while this is a major ruling regarding EPA's ability to regulate carbon emissions, it's not a complete death knell. And I wonder what you make of that.
Well, I think it's severely harming the EPA's ability and our ability in America through our federal agencies to regulate and address the most pressing crisis humankind has ever faced. And so I think in the dissent, Justice Kagan was really spot on in her description of the implications of this decision. It doesn't mean that there's nothing the EPA could do, but the EPA was given a mandate by Congress to help ensure that these power plants had the best emission systems possible. And that included the EPA's determination that would include alternative energy sources. Of course, that's what's necessary to have the best emission systems possible. But this court, this faction that now controls the court, has put its thumb on the scale of justice to stop the EPA from doing the most common sense and reasonable efforts to try to mitigate climate change. And so it really is severely damaging of our ability to address this issue. And I think it affects not only the power within the United States, but also America's power in the world.
Yeah. So to me, there's one of the key questions here is both where does the expertise and authority lie? It seems as if the justices are saying, and I'll just come back to this again and again because it's their core argument in the majority, that the authority fundamentally lies with Congress. First of all, just do you agree with that or not, Lisa?
Well, Congress has the power to delegate those authorities, and it has done so for decades. And so there's no doubt that Congress has the original authority, but Congress has expressly given the EPA the authority to rule in this area to address this pressing crisis. So it's not, I think that in some ways, Justice Roberts' opinion is a bit of sleight of hand, because that's not really the question. The question is whether, having delegated that power, this agency has the power to enact reasonable regulations. And it certainly does. And in past years, for decades now, under the Chevron doctrine, those sorts of regulations would be deferred to because the agency has expertise that Congress doesn't have, as the governor mentioned.
Well, we've got about a minute before our first break. Governor Whitman, let's expand our view here a little bit. I mean, you having been, EPA administrator, do you look across other agencies in the federal government now and see this ruling as potentially having an impact on them?
Absolutely. If you follow the logic and the argument and the majority opinion there, it could easily be applied to the FDA and how we oversee the testing of drugs and getting them out to the population. The same thing with food, the testing of food to make sure it's safe. These are all things that could be impacted by this ruling. That's why I say it's going to take quite a while for people to fully appreciate just how far-reaching this decision is and the kind of impact it can have. And frankly, it's not good. In my opinion, it's not good for the country. It's not good for the future of the country. And I couldn't agree more that it's also severely impacting our ability to work internationally, because the rest of the world has taken this issue seriously for a long time. And now we're walking away from it. It is an excuse for those who also want to walk away from it. And we see the damage that climate change is doing.
Well, Governor Whitman, stand by here for a moment, and Lisa Graves as well. We're talking today about the Supreme Court's ruling last week in West Virginia versus EPA, and really asking, what impact will it have across the board in federal agencies? This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the impact that the Supreme Court's ruling last week in West Virginia versus EPA could actually have on federal agencies across the board. West Virginia Attorney General Patrick Morrisey told Fox News that he thinks the ruling and others expected to come are in fact about more than the EPA, that the larger goal is the weakening of the so-called administrative state, regulatory bodies throughout government, everything from, say, the SEC to the Departments of Health, Labor, Commerce, Homeland Security. Here's Morrisey.
Today, it matters with respect to stopping the EPA's power grab. Tomorrow, it could impact what goes on at the Securities and Exchange Commission and other federal agencies.
I'm joined today by Christine Todd Whitman. She is the former governor of New Jersey and served as EPA administrator under President George W. Bush. Lisa Graves is also with us. She's executive director of the progressive group True North Research. And I'd like to bring in a couple of other voices here to talk about their views as former administrators or members of various agencies about the impact that West Virginia versus EPA might have beyond the EPA itself. So here's Paul DeCamp, and he joins us from Washington. He's a former administrator and senior policy advisor at the Department of Labor's Wage and Hour Division. He served in that position in the George W. Bush administration. He's currently a member of the law firm Epstein, Becker, and Green. Paul DeCamp, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me, Magda.
So, same first question to you. From your experience in the Labor Department, do you see this ruling about EPA potentially having an impact on the Labor Department?
I do think this will have an impact, but I think that the impact will be a positive one. I think the way we read the opinion, it's not saying that agencies don't have authority to issue rulemaking. They just have to do so within the bounds set by Congress, and that for difficult, major, impactful decisions, we need to make extra sure that Congress intended to give that authority to the agencies.
Right. And so that language around the difficult major decisions for the first time appeared in a majority decision as written by Chief Justice John Roberts. But I mean, I suppose from the point of view of a former Labor Department administrator, I mean, how would you define what the difficult major decisions are? Where does the expertise lie in even making that designation?
I think that's going to end up being largely a legal question, because in figuring out whether a question is within the scope of the authority that Congress intended, we'd have to look at the economic impact, the effect on businesses, on individuals, workers, stakeholders, to get a sense of whether this falls within that narrow category of rules. One assumes narrow, that would be covered by the major questions doctrine. There's lots of small rulemakings, relatively non-impactful rulemakings that agencies engage in every day. I don't think those are within the scope of what the Supreme Court was addressing. I think here they're talking about much larger, more significant rulemakings.
Okay. Well, so do you have an example in mind, or can you think of one at Labor where perhaps a major decision was made by the agency itself that now you think might have not been made because of the EPA ruling?
Sure. I mean, there are lots of examples, but one that comes to mind is in the Wage and Hour Division. The agency has issued a rulemaking that effectively grants the department authority to regulate the work that tipped employees engage in at the task level, saying that if people spend more than half an hour not engaged in customer service activities, the employer has to pay them full minimum wage rather than the tipped wage. That's kind of an in-the-weeds example, but it affects millions of workers around the country in hundreds of thousands of locations.
Well, Paul DeCamp, hang on here for just a second. Let me turn back to Governor Whitman, because I know we've got to let you go, Governor. But just your thought on what Paul DeCamp is saying, that yes, it will have a limiting effect, but he doesn't actually see that as a bad thing.
Well, I mean, Congress and the EPA have always been had a kind of a fraught relationship, shall we say, and environmental regulation is never popular. But the point here is we're talking about human health and with the EPA ruling. And we will talk about it, too, when you get to the Department of Health and the other agencies that could be impacted by this and departments. When the goal is to protect human health and the environment, when we have a very clear understanding that certain behaviors, certain things are harmful to human health and the environment, then we've got to act. And unfortunately, we have seen in the past that these big issues, certainly in the recent past, Congress seems to be unable to move forward. As I mentioned earlier, the EPA would have loved to have had Congress act a Clean Air Act, pass the Clean Air Act that the Bush administration sent up. We had a three-pollutant bill that was sent up that would have done a lot for methane and emissions. But Congress wouldn't even hold a hearing. So should we be held hostage to the fact that Congress has gotten so politicized that they don't seem to be able to focus on the big issues, and they only vote through the political prism rather than the policy one.
Hmm. Well, Christine Todd Whitman, former governor of New Jersey and former EPA administrator as well, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Lisa Graves, I'm going to come back to you in just a moment, but Paul DeCamp, I'm eager to hear your response to what Christine Todd Whitman said just then, because she is absolutely right in terms of Congress's overall gridlock and the difficulty of actually passing legislation that gives this kind of specific direction that you're talking about. And yet the needs of the industries, the businesses, and the people that fall under the regulatory umbrella of, you know, agencies like labor, those needs march on. So how do you square that in terms of the agencies need to do something because the economy presses forward, but Congress can't act? So what happens?
Well, I don't think it's that Congress can't act. It's that Congress has not had to act for about 50 years. What we've seen over the past several decades is that the courts and the executive branch agencies have stepped into the breach and been more than willing to make the tough policy choices, which lets Congress off the hook. The question here is not whether we should have Congress making hard policy choices or neutral experts who reside in the agencies. If we really look at how rulemakings happen at the agencies, all of those decisions, the tough decisions, the policy decisions, are made by political appointees of one party. And so for those who would advocate for broad regulatory authority at an agency right now, ask whether they would be just as comfortable with political appointees of the opposite political party making those same decisions, because the pendulum always swings. There is a body of technical expertise at the agencies, sure, but the people who are really making the decisions are the roughly 1% of individuals at most department-level bodies who are the political appointees. It's not the career people who are making these choices.
So, Lisa Graves, to you now, what's your response to Paul DeCamp essentially saying that the people making the policy decisions at the agencies are, you know, because of the changes in executive or from administration to administration, more partisan, in fact, and that in itself is a problem?
I think it's interesting to describe these agencies as more partisan than Congress. I certainly don't agree with that description of it. And the fact is that the agencies, do have a rulemaking process that provides democratic input. And so there's plenty of opportunity for people, for industries, for corporations to weigh in during that rulemaking process that is open to the public and have their say. And I think that one of the things that's also obscured in some ways in this theoretical debate about Congress's power is that actually Congress has the power to act to remove agency authority if it thinks the agency goes too far. And so if the Congress had a majority to say, to this agency or another agency, it went too far, it could pass a law to restrict those authorities. In this instance, Congress, created the Clean Air Act and directed the EPA to identify the best systems of emission reduction. And that was a very clear and specific mandate and delegation of authority. What's happened really in this scenario and many scenarios is that you have this industry money, special interest money that is really flooding the field. And so, in Congress, the reason Congress hasn't acted on enacting new authorities over the Clean Air Act is because there's so much fossil fuel money that has just come into these congressional races and these Senate races, and it has really obstructed the ability of we the people to have modern and really bold energy policy other than this delegation. It's also the case that these same industries have funded Patrick Morrisey's operations. I've been investigating Raga for a number of years, and we've documented how the fossil fuel industry has given millions of dollars to the Republican Attorneys General Association with Morrisey at the helm and spearheading this litigation. We know that ExxonMobil, that Koch Industries has given, hundreds of thousands of dollars. But more than that, we know that there's a secretive dark money operation that is really funding these efforts in some ways. And it's Leonard Leo's very closely tied Judicial Crisis Network, which is now known as the Concord Fund, they've given $16 million to RAGA, and no one knows who the funders are. But we do know that Koch, Charles Koch, one of the richest billionaires in the world, has had this agenda to attack the so-called administrative state, to attack the ability of agencies to issue regulations across the board in numerous areas, including the EPA, but beyond the EPA. And so really what's behind this story here is that there are a number of groups that filed amicus briefs to this court that are funded by dark money, including Koch money. And this Supreme Court now has a number of justices who were put on the court by spending by some of those same groups, Leonard Leo's groups, Koch groups,
so,
and more.
Lisa, yes. Let me just step in here because I do actually want to talk in detail about that part of the story a little later in the show. So I do promise we will come back to it.
Sure.
But before we have to let Paul DeCamp go, Paul, I just wanted to ask you again. I hear what you're saying about about your view of the partisanship that can be seen in regulatory agencies because of how they're structured and that 1% at the top of decision makers coming in based on, who's currently in the White House. But I look back at the deeper legal history that got us here. And many decades ago, when Justice Stevens first wrote about, what became the idea that the courts should defer to reasonable decisions made by agencies, he later defended his decision, saying that while agencies are not directly accountable to the people, the chief executive is, and it is entirely appropriate for this political branch of government to make such policy choices. In fact, asserting the opposite of what you're saying, that because of, if you want to call it partisanship, that makes that there's a form of accountability there that comes through the ballot box when people vote for the next president.
Sure, that's the original theory behind deferring to agency expertise. But I think that, for example, we look at Justice Scalia, who authored the Chevron decision, who later came to regret it, who understood that what was happening in the agencies was not a bunch of technical experts making objective scientific decisions. There is objective expertise in the agencies, but the policy choices are being made purely by very partisan political appointees. And there's accountability at the ballot box every 4 years or so, sure. But the real issue here is who should be making laws in the United States? Who should be making major policy choices? Should that be Congress or should it be the executive branch? We normally think of the legislature as enacting the laws, and we think of the executive branch as enforcing them. Increasingly, what we've seen is it's really the executive branch that is making the laws in the first place, and that's a problem for our separation of powers.
Well, Paul DeCamp, former administrator and senior policy advisor at the Department of Labor's Wage and Hour Division in the George W. Bush administration, currently a member of the law firm Epstein, Becker & Green. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, let's turn now to Christopher Wright to get another view of the potential impact in other federal agencies. He was general counsel at the FCC in the Clinton administration and served in the Solicitor General's office in the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations. And he's currently a partner at the law firm Harris, Wiltshire & Grannis. Christopher Wright, welcome to you.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to join this important discussion. If I may, I think I'd like to point out that sort of I've seen agencies act in Democratic and Republican administrations, and I found that most policymakers were trying very hard in good faith to solve real world problems. And I see this major question doctrine as simply unnecessarily throwing sand in the gears of agency policymakers trying to do the right thing.
Tell us more about that. If I could interject here, Mr. Wright, and forgive me for doing so, but you just heard Paul DeCamp, right, say that he sees a pattern of agencies making the law, is essentially what he said, in creating those policies, not allowing Congress to do so. Your response specifically to that?
Sure. So, of course, agencies don't have any authority unless Congress gives it to them. But let me point out that the major question doctrine only matters when an agency has authority under its statute, but a court sort of puts a thumb on the scale and says, oh, okay, but geez, this is really important. So I'm going to decide you can't try to solve this problem, which seems sort of, you know, counterintuitive. You would think it would be most important to get the major questions addressed. But again, you know, if the court only needed to invoke this major question doctrine because it thought that Section 111 of the Clean Air Act gave EPA the authority it exercised. If the answer had been that the statute just doesn't give EPA authority, that would have been the end of the case. And I think we've had a sort of a, I thought this was settled in the 30s, frankly, that, you know, the country, you know, was much bigger and much more complicated. And there was a very sensible division of authority where Congress created agencies, gave them broad power, and said, you know, go solve these specific problems we're assigning your agency to solve. And of course, it's important to understand that Congress can always amend the statute to overrule something an agency does.
So sorry, Christopher Wright. It's just that the music means that we've got to careen towards the next break here. But Christopher Wright and Lisa Graves, hang on here for a moment, because we're trying to understand the broader impact of the Supreme Court's ruling in West Virginia versus EPA about, you know, what can federal agencies do in terms of rulemaking? What should be deferred to Congress? Where does the power, the authority, and the expertise lie? We'll take a look at more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Just a quick heads up on a show we're working on for later this week. It's about the end of the universal free school lunch program, that pandemic era program that extended free school lunches to every school child in the United States. That program has come to an end now. It's gone back to an income-based requirement. So we want to hear from you, from families, from parents. Did that universal free school lunch program make a difference for you, for your family, at your school, in your community, and educators, teachers, administrators? What was it like administrating that program? Was it better than the old one? This is a program that seemed to have worked during the period of the pandemic. It will not be extended. What do you think about that? Tell us your story at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for later this week. Today, we are talking about the Supreme Court's major ruling in West Virginia versus EPA. And it's really raised the question of the impact that it will have on other federal agencies in the United States and their ability to make rules and regulations. It seems that it could potentially curtail those agencies' abilities. And we're joined by Lisa Graves. She's executive director of the progressive watchdog group True North Research. And Christopher Wright joins us as well. He was general counsel at the FCC in the Clinton administration and also served in the Solicitor General's office in the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations. And Christopher Wright, I'm an examples person. I feel like we can learn a lot from the real world of experience with people who've done the work. So can you tell us a little bit about, you know, is there an example that you can think of at, say, FCC, where FCC either needed to or tried to promulgate some rules that came up against, I don't know, the barrier of Congress not being clear, or the judiciary saying, well, FCC can't go so far in its rulemaking?
Sure. You know, I immediately thought of a whole number of examples. Perhaps a good one would be from the George W. Bush administration, though, after I left the FCC, where there was a difficult problem that arose because first responders were getting a lot of interference from wireless carriers like Nextel, even though everybody was following the rules. And sure, you could say Congress could have stepped in and done something, but it didn't. But a bipartisan group at the FCC encouraged Nextel to essentially buy spectrum elsewhere, except instead of paying for it straightforwardly, it paid for it by fixing up the 800 megahertz band for first responders who needed hundreds of millions of dollars to get equipment to be able to provide service in that band. And so it was a great example of solving a real world problem creatively. Mm-hmm. But while the statute gives the FCC broad authority over licensing, it had never done anything like that before. And if that issue arose today, I worry that, you know, a court might have said, well, geez, this is important. This involves hundreds of millions of dollars. So I'm not going to let the FCC do this, even though it makes sense on a bipartisan basis. I argued a case that in the 90s that Chief Justice Roberts cited as one of the first major question cases, even though I didn't really understand it that way at the time. But it's a little scary now because the issue was whether the FCC could order telephone companies not to file rate schedules once their markets became competitive. And that was decided to be too important for the FCC to decide. And while I may be offending some of my friends in the communications bar, I think others might be thinking if filing rate schedules is too important for an agency to decide whether it needs to be done, what isn't likely to be decided to be a major question in the future?
Now, is this the MCI versus AT&T case?
That's right.
Or is that different?
Right.
Okay. And so I think you had a particular interaction with Justice Scalia.
Yes.
In arguing that case.
Yes. So I have the transcript here. So the statute says that telephone companies shall file tariffs, which are rate schedules, but it also said the FCC could modify that requirement. And I was saying that, filing the FCC's decision was a permissible modification of that rule. But Justice Scalia actually sort of sang to me, he said, and I'm quoting here, "There's a wonderful line in The Messiah, Mr. Wright, where it says, 'And we shall be changed.' There's a feeling of transformation about it. And you say that it could be sung, 'And we shall be modified.'" So that's end of the quote. And then he wrote the opinion for four other justices, deciding that this was just too important for the FCC to make that decision. Yeah. I will say this was a case where Congress actually overruled the court and amended the statute so that the FCC can now decide who files rate schedules.
So it is possible. We've got one more question before I have to let you go, Mr. Wright. Just honestly, what do you think the future impact could be on agencies from this case?
Well, I think it is simply going to interfere with policymakers at agencies who are trying to decide what they can do to solve important problems, because they're going to have to worry not only did Congress give our agency this authority, but also sort of if we exercise it, is a court going to come along and say, nah, that's just too important for you to have done? And it'll take a long time to sort out what's major and what's not.
Well, Christopher Wright, he was a general counsel at the FCC in the Clinton administration, as you heard. He also served in the Solicitor General's office in the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations. Today, he's a partner at Harris, Wiltshire, and Grannis. Christopher Wright, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Okay, so Lisa Graves, I appreciate your patience here, and I want to bring us back to what you were talking about before, this sort of broader, years-long effort to change the way that the judiciary really sees federal agencies and the judiciary's responsibility in terms of curtailing or not those agencies' power. Because the EPA case was just one, right, brought before federal courts. This one happened to work its way up to the Supreme Court. And it's just one of them backed by a coalition of Republican policymakers and advocates, including the Republican Attorneys General Association and the Federalist Society. Back in 2018, during the Trump administration, then White House counsel Don McGahn spoke at the Conservative Political Action Committee conference. And he talked about this organized effort that I just mentioned of reforming the fundamental approach the judiciary takes in questions regarding federal regulatory agencies.
Well, it's not a coincidence. It's a part of a larger plan, I suppose. You see this catching on more and more. There was a time not long ago where no one really spoke of administrative law or the administrative state or whatever one wants to call it. And now you see more and more legal conferences on this. The Federalist Society had their annual lawyers conference last year. The whole topic was administrative law.
So, Lisa Graves, let's step back from the Supreme Court itself and talk more about where else do we see efforts to, and cases being brought that have to do with this desire to curtail the so-called administrative state?
Well, I think there are a number of examples, and certainly Charles Koch's Americans for Prosperity and the Cato Institute, which he helped co-found, and other groups, along with the Federal Society, which both he funds through his philanthropic efforts and through Koch Industries, have been at the forefront of trying to remake American law, modern American law, to sort of go back to before the New Deal, to really limit the ability of agencies to issue regulations. And so you can see that in a host of areas. I was reading some of the writings from the right wing this past weekend, just trumpeting this decision and talking about how this could be opens up avenues to attack the Fish and Wildlife Service's designations of critical habitat. It opens up opportunities to attack the Federal Trade Commission's regulations of big tech's data collection practices and more. And so you now have a court that Don McGahn has worked with Leonard Leo, who helps lead the Federal Society's board and was formerly its vice president. They helped put justices on this court, and their jurisdiction is almost entirely discretionary. This year, they took 66 cases. 65 of them were cases that were not mandatory jurisdiction. And that means that this court has now created a path through this so-called major questions doctrine to revisit any regulation it dislikes or that a faction, the majority faction on that court, dislikes. That could be in the areas of OSHA. It could be mining laws. It could be DHS rules on the Affordable Care Act. A whole range of issues. Now, this court has said that it can set aside the agency's reasonable regulations because they believe the issue is too major. And I think Christopher Wright's analysis was so illuminating and so astute about that being precisely what the agencies are tasked to do, to issue major rulings that Congress has delegated to it. And that the idea that Paul put forward, like that non-impactful regulations are okay, that would just utterly weaken and decimate the ability of the federal government to act. And that is, unfortunately, precisely the vision that Charles Koch has set forth in through numerous organizations since the 1970s, when he got involved in really trying to change the course of federal law. And so, yeah, everything's at stake.
Mm-hmm. You know, I definitely hear the follow the money edict loud and clear here. And at the same time, there seems to be kind of political resonance amongst even many of our listeners that the ruling has had. For example, we've got a couple of listeners, Ray Russell and Stephen Hames, who say controversial issues should be decided in the halls of Congress. Giving too much power to the federal government leads to authoritarianism. And Stephen adds that that's the source of tyrannies. Unelected bureaucrats levying fees, extorting commerce, and inventing their own regulations. I just want, you know, what's your response to that, Lisa?
Well, I think that rhetoric is quite strong and you know, overboard, because these agencies are not engaged in tyranny. This is not authoritarianism. This is living in a modern society that has complex challenges, whether it's labor challenges or health and safety issues in terms of the workplace, or products that may harm or kill people's kids or their spouses or their parents. And these agencies have expertise and scientists on board who are looking seriously at these issues and trying very hard to address the problems that Congress has delegated to it. And Congress is accountable, at least in theory, to the American people, and has made these decisions to delegate. And so I really think that sort of rhetoric is, while it may be sincere, it's really overblown.
You know, I keep coming back to how much sort of flip-flopping there has been, if for lack of a better phrase, because, again, just to remind listeners, EPA created the Clean Power Plan for climate or carbon regulation because the Supreme Court said it had to back in 2007 due to another case, that Massachusetts versus EPA case. So here's a case. There was a moment where the Supreme Court said, no, in fact, EPA, you as a regulatory agency, must create these new rules and new plans under the Clean Air Act. So being very focused and clear in its view of the agency's powers at that time and responsibilities. And similarly, if I remember my history correctly, that Chevron deference that you talked about earlier, Lisa, decades ago, that was supported by conservatives and Republicans because of their concerns about what they saw as, an unelected liberal judiciary, perhaps overreaching, and that the judiciary should be deferential to the other branches of government. So it's a little head spinning sometimes here to understand what's going on. But fundamentally, one thing that has been consistent from conservatives and Republicans is the argument for limited government. I mean, this would then seem to fit perfectly into that argument, would it not, the court's ruling?
Well, it would. It certainly is limiting the ability of the EPA to govern, to issue rules affecting the most devastating crisis that the human race is facing. But I do think that that terminology, limited government, which is a hallmark of almost any group that's funded by the Koch carbon fortune, really is a proxy for limited democracy, because when you don't have these sorts of rules, what you have is corporations doing basically what they will. So in this instance, you have utilities and the fossil fuel industry being able to avoid government rules, government regulations that are designed to help protect us and help protect our planet. And so when you think of limited government, the opposite, or the effect of that is increased power by corporations over our lives. And for corporations, we have almost no real power to control them. We don't have a democratic process with them. We have some consumer powers in terms of choosing some products, but we can't really constrain them. Only the federal government and the state governments can, and only these agencies that have expertise really have the power to make sure these corporations aren't putting their financial interests above the interests of our society, above our human health, as corporations have done numerous times, that's been documented, whether it's tobacco industry or other industries. And so it is consistent, but that terminology really is one that ultimately weakens the power of we the people to govern and limit the power of corporations.
And in the last 30 seconds, you've seen similar cases, not just in the federal courts, but at the state level as well, Lisa?
That's right. There is an effort as well to take away California's exception to create stronger standards. And so it's many of these same groups that are involved here are assailing the power of states to do more, to do better, to protect our environment, to protect our planet. So it's been a joy to be on your show, Meghna. There's so much happening, and I really appreciate the chance to talk with you about it.
Well, Lisa Graves, Executive Director at True North Research, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.